The Guardian.
Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast, brought to you in association with Squarespace. To find out more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
Now, naturally, people want to know what Brexit will mean.
Brexit means Brexit. Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means breakfast.
Breakfast. Brexit.
So in closing, I'd simply say this. Brexit means Brexit.
Welcome to The Guardian's Brexit podcast, Brexit Means. I'm John Henley. Coming up in this episode, we're talking, sorry for this, Brex and the City. How will Brexit affect one of Britain's biggest and most important industries, financial services? What does it mean for jobs, investments, and Britain's place in the world? How reliant is the rest of the EU on London's banking sector? And what are the opportunities for Europe's other financial centres? Joining me to discuss it all, Guardian City editor Jill Trainer, our Brexit policy editor Dan Roberts, Vincenzo Scarpetta, who's a senior policy analyst at the Open Europe think tank, and Anthony Brown, who's chief executive of the British Bankers Association. But first, a bit of background. Britain's financial services industry employs over 1 million people, the majority of them, believe it or not, outside London. It accounts directly for 7% of Britain's GDP and contributes billions of pounds in tax revenue. London, for now, is the leading financial services centre in the world, way ahead of any other European city, but only just ahead of New York. In short, it has a lot to lose from a major disruption, and some banks are already making decisions to move. Here's what Andrea Orsell, the president of Swiss bank UBS, said of its London operations in Davos last week.
Yes, we will have to move bankers, and I think that we have an SC in Frankfurt, we have an appropriate setup in Spain. We have still flexibility to decide where to go, but we will definitely have to move.
But it's not all one-sided. The city is vital to Europe too. Billions of euros flow in and out of London every day as EU businesses rely on the expertise of the giant financial ecosystem in the City of London to arrange everything from loans, derivatives, insurance, and currency trading. All of which could get potentially much more expensive if business moves out of the city. And furthermore, as we learnt from the financial crash, tinkering with financial services regulations can have unintended consequences that only show up years later. Well, Brexit Means went down to the square mile to take a highly unscientific straw poll of exactly what city workers make of Brexit during their lunch hour.
Complete uncertainty. Total and utter uncertainty. And with that uncertainty comes no inward investment. So with no inward investment goes no projects, no new jobs, and until everything's sorted out, as in until there's a clear path, and whether that clear path actually still means that the City of London is a place to do business, we're going to see a hiatus of pretty much uncertainty for the next couple of years, maybe longer, 3, 4, 5 years.
I think it's going to, being in the single market or not, could impact businesses. But then we keep getting changes from time to time. So, and we've been able to cope with the changes. So, I mean, there's good and bad on both sides, right? So it's about finding a balance. That would be my view.
Absolutely thrilled. Best thing ever. We've been waiting for this for years. The sterling's plummeted, and as most of our earnings are in euros and dollars, it's a win-win. Tax advantages. We could be an offshore shelter. We'll attract plenty of investment into this country. We've got a steady government, no migrants. It's all going to be good.
Well, my position is that the UK government has not been in control of the UK economy and all the things that feed into the economy for such a long time. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how we can negotiate new deals with the whole world rather than just our European partners. So I very much welcome it. I voted to come out. I'm pleased we came out. I think it is a risk, but I think it was the lesser of the risks, because with us having self-determination I think we have the ability to stand up and stand by decisions that we make.
It's pretty much all doom and gloom in insurance because people, a lot of insurers are already looking to move abroad to Ireland. Some have already started moving across. I don't think that there could be anything great from it. The currency devaluation is making us less competitive in the States especially, and going forwards in Europe as well.
Well, some of you may be thinking by now, so thousands of bankers are going to leave the country. Where's the problem? But Anthony Brown, CEO of the British Banking Association, just what do you think is at stake for your industry, especially now that we know that we're heading out of the single market? And how important potentially for that for the country is that?
Will the industry survive? Yes. Are there opportunities, potentially, on the upside? Yes. It is a period of massive uncertainty. In terms of the scale of it, I mean, financial services pays about £70 billion worth of tax to the government each year to pay for schools and hospitals, and that's some of that is potentially at risk. I mean, if you were, simple mathematics, if you were to lose 10% of that, then that would be £7 billion a year, which is a huge loss to the Treasury, which is part of the reason why the UK Treasury is actually quite supportive of financial services, because we know how much of the tax bill we pay, which is obviously of benefit to everyone.
Jill, there is an argument on the left of politics, at least, isn't there, that goes something like this. You know, the banks haven't atoned for the crisis that they caused in 2008. The bonus money never really trickles down. And instead, these are people who are basically concerned just with accumulating wealth for themselves, and we're better off without them. Good riddance. Is that short-sighted?
Well, there are statistics. I mean, you've talked about a statistic where 1 million people are employed in financial services. You can say that across the entire UK, 2.2 million people are in fact working in the industry in some way or another. I think we often forget that banks like JP Morgan have got people working in Bournemouth and all around the UK. There are these investment banks are in somehow connected in. Now, have banks, you know, said sorry often enough for the mistakes they made in 2008? Well, I think we'd probably all agree that isn't the case. And does it look as if the industry carried on pretty well with the help of the taxpayers afterwards? They probably did. But it probably is, I would say, a reasonably short-sighted argument when you look at what the banking industry is more than it than the city.
OK, so I mean, it clearly is a very important player in the UK economy, Anthony. I mean, does that mean that the government is automatically sympathetic to the bank's concerns? Do you have the feeling that you're genuinely being listened to?
It's big for the economy. One other factor is we're the biggest export industry by far. And we actually have a bigger net exports than all other net exporting sectors combined, which is brilliant for the UK's balance of payments, or our trade deficit would be twice as big as it is at the moment if we didn't have banking. So again, another reason why the Treasury is supportive of banking. Good engagement with the government, I have to say, now. There are obviously various views across government. I mean, the banks haven't got friends everywhere, it has to be said. You know, there are plenty of critics in different places, and the banks are obviously, you know, have had a lot of problems, have been trying to sort themselves out. But I think most people at the top level of government do realise how important it is for the wider economy. It is one sector where we are genuinely a global leader, our biggest export industry, 2 million jobs, two-thirds of those outside of London. And in many parts of the UK, the biggest employer, I mean, JP Morgan, which you mentioned, is actually the biggest private sector employer in the whole of Dorset. And Morgan Stanley in Glasgow, Deutsche Bank in Birmingham, and all these places will be affected if financial services shrinks.
That's interesting. I mean, we don't really know about this, do we? When we think of the financial services sector, most people, I guess, think strictly of the, speaking of the city. Dan, what's your take on that? I mean, you're Brexit policy editor, you're in touch with sort of many branches of government. Do you get the feeling that the government, is it fair to say that the government maybe, or some parts of government, aren't prepared to prioritise the needs of bankers over its other concerns?
I think it's definitely true there's been a bit of a shift, especially since the referendum. Theresa May seems instinctively less warm towards the city, perhaps, than David Cameron was, and certainly than Tony Blair was, and the notion post-crash that the city is this sort of crown jewel that must be protected at all costs, I think, has been replaced by a slightly more nuanced view that perhaps some rebalancing the economy might not be a bad thing. The government's new industrial strategy, which we saw unveiled recently, very much talks up the importance of car making and aerospace and pharmaceuticals. And there wasn't a lot of talk about financial services there. I'm sure that the British Bankers Association and others are doing an awful lot of work behind the scenes to make sure that, that the risks are understood. But I think that there is definitely a little less knee-jerk sort of we must do what they tell us feeling.
Yeah, and it's interesting the arguments themselves that the banks are starting to put forwards. For instance, Douglas Flint, the chairman of HSBC, gave evidence to one of the select committees this month and was talking about, you know, he used this analogy of Jenga. It's almost, you know, you pull something out, you don't know what's going to happen, the tower falls down. Believe him or not, that's your decision. But I suppose the arguments the banks themselves are now putting forward is actually, you know, actually we are. There is plenty of risk out there. So sort of goes back to your argument of, you know, do we care about the banking system? Well, we might care if we get back into the sort of bailout scenarios.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that I'm necessarily suggesting that, but it's obviously a concern among the industry itself.
Yeah. Let's look in a little bit more detail at some of the what those precise risks are then. Vincenzo, I mean, this the big issue that everybody talks about, even people I think who don't necessarily follow the city particularly, is this question of passporting. Can you explain, you know, for anybody who's kind of not up with it, what is passporting and how important is it?
So passporting in one sentence means that under EU law, it is possible for a firm with its headquarters in London and authorised by the UK national regulator to provide services across the block. This can happen in two ways, essentially. One is you can, once you have access to the passport, you can open branches across the rest of the EU. And the other one is that you can provide your services on a cross-border basis. So you can serve clients elsewhere in the European Union. Now, the importance of the passport changes. I mean, at least we have been doing at Open Europe a lot of work. We have published a report recently, and the importance of the financial services passport varies depending on which industry we're talking about. So the passport is important to business in some sectors, but is it can be less relevant to business in other sectors. So and this depends mostly on whether there are alternatives on offer to the passport once the passport is gone. So, for example, in terms of wholesale banking, so everything which all banking services ranging from deposit taking, lending, payment services, at the moment under EU legislation, there is no provision for third country access. So what does that mean? It means that once you are out of the EU, it gets more complicated to have access to the market. So wholesale banking would be a sector more exposed to the hit from losing the passport. But when you look, for example, at asset management, when you look at insurance, because insurance is by its own nature a more globally diversified industry, there are sectors where the impact of the passport could be less important. The impact of losing the passport could be less important because there are alternatives, there are ways around it.
Okay. Anthony, how certain is the sector to lose passporting? Is it automatic?
So as currently constructed, you only get a passport for countries that are members of the single market, members as opposed to those who have access to it. So in the European Economic Area, either members of the EU or, say, the Norway option. Now, you could potentially see a system where you have passporting rights if you're not a member of the single market, if you're outside the European Economic Area, but you still get the rights to sell to customers across the border in the EU27 and the remaining EU, or to set up branches there without separate authorisation. You can call it a mutual access agreement, call it free trade in financial services. It is what certainly we want as an industry. It's what we think the UK government certainly publicly says it wants, and we certainly think it's in the interest of European companies in particular, the customers of banks, to be able to carry on getting the services from the UK. Now, we do know from what Theresa May said that we're not going to be members of the single market, so that automatic passporting that comes from being a member of the single market, that will go. But as I said, there are alternatives, other options that we could potentially develop as non-members of the EU.
And it's not just a question, you can't, I mean, so, for example, HSBC couldn't simply just kind of, you know, stick a brass plaque on its office in Frankfurt and say...
Those days are long gone. I mean, this was an argument that came up during the referendum campaign and, you know, might have been the case some time ago. But actually, there's a lot of financial regulations being brought in since the financial crisis to make sure the crisis doesn't happen again that makes it impossible
possible to do that. So if you set up a subsidiary in another EU country or in an EU country, then it needs to be a proper subsidiary. You need to have a proper risk function there, a compliance function. You need to have proper board of directors. You need a proper IT system that's robust and standalone. It needs to be separately capitalized with its own pool of money, and it should be able to effectively carry on if the parent company fails. You don't do that just by having a brass plate on the door. So all that, if banks are considering doing that as one way round continuing to serve customers once we leave the EU, it all comes with costs. And that is one of the issues for the banks, that actually if you've got a marginal business line, then actually all those added costs, that duplication of costs in London and in the new EU subsidiary, might mean that you just think it's not worthwhile doing this business anymore. And as opposed to just moving jobs, which is what you talked about in the introduction, you just decide, actually, we're going to exit those sectors. We're just going to close those jobs down. And that's definitely, you know, one of the other scenarios.
That's a possibility. Is it? I mean, how much of a, I mean, nobody, obviously, clearly nobody wants some kind of really disruptive move if they can avoid it. How much, Dan, are banks kind of waiting and seeing?
Well, what we're hearing is that all of the banks are making preparations, even the ones that say they aren't, are busy behind the scenes applying for licenses and doing the preparatory work. I spoke to somebody the other day who said they've been drawing up lists of spreadsheets of the relative attractions of different banking centres around Europe, and they had up to 150 variables on their spreadsheets of all the different things that they would kind of weigh on their mind, and that process was pretty much complete, and they were now, you know, ready to press the button. What I do think that we're also hearing, though, is that by pressing the button, it may be, to begin with, very, very small. Even the largest of banks, I mean, JP Morgan's sort of been warning of thousands, and others have been warning of hundreds, some just tens. There's pretty small numbers in comparison with the big employment figures we were talking about at the beginning of this. What worries me is that that then begins to undermine the other attractiveness of the city, which is this one-stop shop for companies outside Europe looking for not just access to the European market, but a single financial centre that can offer you everything. So I think we might see two waves here. A first wave where we see up to a few thousand go at some of these big banks. And then a second wave where we have, which is much more unknown, but potentially much more dangerous, where we see other banks say, well, hang on a minute, actually, the city's not this kind of one-stop shop we thought it was. Let's go to New York instead, or Frankfurt, or Singapore, or Hong Kong.
Is that a risk more, do you think, than European cities?
Well, I think that's where that is something that you, to begin with, I was very sceptical of this argument because I was kind of very puzzled with the notion that you heard peddled a lot that, Brexit will just actually benefit New York at the expense of Europe. And it took me a while to work out what people were talking about. And I think they were talking about that second order effect. Clearly, the firms that need to access European markets will need to relocate to within the single market. But it's the second order effect that I think is could well benefit financial capitals outside Europe.
That's interesting. Vincenzo, there are countries outside the EU that have negotiated bespoke financial markets, financial services deals. Switzerland and insurance, for example, got some kind of, you know, quite restrictive but useful for them deal. Are there templates out there that already exist that might work for UK financial services?
So there are two things that we need to consider. The first one is the so-called regulatory equivalence, which is built into a number of pieces of EU legislation, which means essentially that the European Commission considers the financial regulation of a third country just as good and as effective as the European one, and therefore grants some sort of special rights to firms based in that country. In some cases, equivalence can give rights that are similar to passporting rights, but one big shortcoming of equivalence is that it doesn't cover the full spectrum of EU financial services regulation, so it's not available for certain sectors, certain bits and pieces of the financial services industry. And the other aspect that you mentioned is this precedent of this bilateral EU-Swiss agreement on insurance other than life insurance, which is admittedly a very narrow one, but it does set, in our view, a precedent for something that the UK may try to do. Of course, for the UK, given the sheer size of the UK financial services sector, we should be talking, and the UK government should be looking, should aim higher, and should be looking at some sort of larger bespoke agreement. The key issue here is that there are sectors and specific pieces of EU regulations that envisage alternatives to the passport, and it's possible to find mitigating factors, if you like. But there are other sectors where there is no such alternative. There is no equivalence, for example, built into regulations for, as I said before, for wholesale banking, for instance. And therefore, this means that the UK would need to seek bespoke agreements to cover for those specific sectors. And it's important that the government works together with the industry to really find out which are the sectors where the passport adds value, and therefore the government needs to put in an extra effort in the negotiations with the rest of the EU.
Okay. Now, Jill, I mean, it's not just about the sort of nitty-gritty of the agreements that are reached, is it? Because, you know, financial services rely on huge pools of sort of capital and expertise, accumulated expertise, and it's not that easy to establish that somewhere else. I mean, it won't necessarily be easy to replicate London, the sort of London ecosystem, anywhere else in Europe, will it?
Well, that's certainly the argument that UK bankers and are putting forward, this idea that you can somehow create what they call the ecosystem in Paris or Frankfurt or some such like is, it, to their minds, difficult to do. You know, they're talking about the lawyers, the accountants, the PR people and all the other people who are involved in making the city tick. And also the fact that London is such a big city compared to all the other places that are being muted. But I also think we're probably not talking about lock, stock and barrel moving the whole of London somewhere else. We're talking about, as has been said already, moving about bits of business. I mean, we could talk about euro clearing if you want to get into the geek of it. But the big argument, really, that I think is probably to be fought over, and I'm not sure what the answer is about how you... which financial centre will end up being in charge of clearing stuff denominated in euros. Right now it goes through London. It's a massive industry. And if that, for some reason, if the European authorities can convince somebody somewhere that those can no longer be cleared through London, then people say that the prospect of huge job cuts is enormous in the city.
That is, I mean, Dan, the European Central Bank has once more suggested that it, you know, London should be stripped of this euro clearing business. Why is that so important? Just simply because of the size of it?
Well, it's certainly a big chunk of business, and there's a lot of backroom work involved in settlement and clearing, as people around this table know better than me. But I think, to my mind, it's also indicative of one of the big weaknesses of Britain's negotiating position when it goes into Brexit, which is that there's an alignment in Europe of regulatory interest and business interest here, that the ECB has an understandable concern about making sure there's proper liquidity for clearing in derivatives and so forth, and wants that kept within the Eurozone. But it also would suit Frankfurt for such business to be relocated outside of London. And in the past, our line of defence in this has been taking them to the European Court of Justice, which we will also no longer have access to. So I think there is it's a worrying signal of how, if Europe is minded, and if Brexit turns out to be as nasty and bitter and prolonged as we think it might be, that they can use these regulatory arguments to extract real important and lasting commercial advantage, and potentially not much London can then do about it.
Anthony, how can you counter that? I mean, if we accept that we are heading out of the single market, that it may, as Dan says, actually be kind of quite nasty and a bit of a sort of a train crash. You know, what are your lobbyists concretely asking the government for? What do you want them to demand?
So we want as much access to, not membership of, access to the single market, ideally, as we have at the moment, that on a two-way basis. So the banks based in the UK can carry on serving their customers in the EU27 and vice versa, because it is very much two-way. We want as much clarity about that as early as possible. We realise the UK government's negotiating with 27 other governments, and it's difficult to get clarity earlier on. But we also want an orderly transition. And so one of our asks has been... for a transition agreement, if you want to call it that, or a phase-in agreement was the phrase that the Prime Minister used.
Implementation
phase, period. There's lots of different terminology we can use about it. This is not, to be clear, an attempt to delay the UK leaving the EU. We'll leave, presumably, in 2019. But it's an attempt to try and avoid the cliff edge effect that all the regulations that currently
control our trade between the UK and the EU27 fall away the day we leave the EU. So that £20 billion a year trade surplus that we have with the rest of the EU loses most of its legal basis. What will be in its place at that time? Because it'll take quite a long time, we think, for the UK to agree a new partnership deal between the UK and the EU. Could take quite a few years. So we need something in place to bridge to that new partnership deal, but also then to phase in the new arrangements. And that's what our ask has been. But to come back to some of the other points made, I mean, London clearly will survive as a financial centre, as I said at the beginning. In fact, a lot of our business is truly global, which isn't directly affected by Brexit. We have an extraordinary pool of talent here, as well as the normal things that we've been talking about for years, like the time zone and the rule of law and the English language, etc. The banks are desperately trying to work out ways to avoid moving staff. They don't want to move staff away from the UK. Their staff have houses here. They've got kids that go to school here, etc. And people quite like living in London. But there are, you know, some staff they can't avoid moving, or they work out they're legally required to. So they will move some staff. But it will be bits of operations, and maybe they might move a bit to Dublin, a bit to Frankfurt, whatever. I don't think there'll be one single centre like Frankfurt that will suddenly take over the whole lot. So, as I said at the beginning, you know, are there challenges? Absolutely, there are challenges. You know, and but will London survive? Absolutely, it will survive in the long term. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it does depend partly on the agreement we get between the UK and the EU27, and that is going to be difficult. We think it's in the interest of both sides to get a good deal, to retain this free flow of financial services that, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, that it would make it easier and cheaper for companies and businesses and governments in Europe to raise finance for investment. But, you know, there are many trade negotiations where we don't end up with the optimal outcome. And so banks are having to prepare for the worst.
Yeah. I mean, and meanwhile, of course, those other cities that you mentioned are not just sitting around on their hands. They're making active preparations while Britain is making up its mind and deciding what it wants. And indeed, even before negotiations begin. I did a ring round some of the financial centres hoping to capitalise on Brexit, starting with Michael Kemmer of the Association of German Banks in Frankfurt.
Well, I think that Frankfurt has good opportunities to profit a little bit from the Brexit, because Frankfurt is a very good hub for London bankers. It has several advantages also compared to other competitors like Paris, Amsterdam, Dublin. Frankfurt is a kind of a regulatory capital of the European Union. ECB is based in Frankfurt. EIOPA is based in Frankfurt. We think it would make a lot of sense to put also EBA to Frankfurt. And Frankfurt is a smaller city. It is very fast to reach. There is a good airport, and it's only limited time what people need to commute. We have a lot of good universities, and we think that there are some factors where the government should a little bit change the laws to be more proper for the bankers who come to Frankfurt. But in general, we think Frankfurt has good opportunities.
What kind of measures are there? Are they around sort of things like taxation and,
yes,
and employment law, that kind, yes, of thing? What would you like to see the government do?
Employment law is an important point. We have a very restrictive employment law. We think it would be appropriate that the people who earn a lot of money don't profit so much from this restricted employment law. And there are already discussions with the German government, and I see some readiness to work on that. We see some tax issues. For example, banking levy is in Germany not tax deductible. This is absolutely unacceptable. This has to be changed. We have some more technical legal issues which can be changed. I think in general, Frankfurt has a good basis, has a good opportunity. And if we have these smaller amendments in the legal environment, I think Frankfurt can profit really from the Brexit.
To make it easier to fire bankers, in other words, we want to measure
when
it comes down to.
This is one of the points. And if we talk to British bankers, they say one of the biggest obstacles to put stuff to Frankfurt is really this restrictive labor law, because we need more flexibility. And I think it is really appropriate that if you earn 500,000 euros, that you are not so much protected from the labor law. I think this is a real point.
Are you in already, or is Frankfurt, do you know, already in sort of concrete discussions with some banks about moving over?
As far as I know, they are. There are a lot of banks who are contacting BaFin, who are contacting Frankfurt's offices, who are contacting the regional government of Hessen, and who are talking with them. How concrete this really is, I don't know. I think all of the banks are currently discussing their plans. We expect decisions to be taken in the first half of 2017. It may be that there are already decisions. We've read that in the newspapers last week. But whether there are concrete negotiations with some officials from Frankfurt or from the regional government, I don't know, but could be that they are already in discussions, and I would expect that.
Frankfurt is by no means the only other city vying for post-Brexit business. Earlier, I spoke to Arnaud de Bresson of Paris Europlace. I asked him what advantages Paris might have.
First point is that when we ask international bankers what is the difference between Paris and Frankfurt, for example, in the European Union, it's quite funny to hear that the big difference is that Frankfurt is a city of banks and Paris is a business center, the city of corporates, French and international corporates, which are their clients. And many international bankers say, for almost this reason, that's much more interesting to think to implementation near our clients more than to our competitors. And second, these corporates are very capital market-minded. We are very near from London in terms of capital market culture. And last but not least, if we consider all data, all the statistics concerning the wide range of the financial industry activities, Paris very clearly is number one in terms of financing center in the European Union, apart from London.
Right.
Frankfurt has some strengths on the interest rate derivatives with Eurex and the Deutsche Börse activities, mm-hmm. and also on the banking credit. But if you consider equity markets, if you consider corporate bonds, Paris is number one in terms of corporate bonds issuing, even ahead of London. If you consider the asset management activity, Paris is a double size of Germany, behind London, but double size of Germany. Insurance sector is number two in Europe after UK. So we also have a very dynamic and vibrant development of innovation and fintech.
Arnaud de Bresson and earlier, Michael Kemmel. So clearly, other financial capitals aren't hanging around waiting for Britain to decide what it wants. Jill, who are in the field? Who might take over?
We finally started to get a bit more clarity about this. Citi, which is huge US bank, has been talking about the financial centres that it's been talking to. So it's listed Ireland, Italy, France, Spain, Germany and the Netherlands. So there you go. I'm assuming that Citi is the sort of got the same winners and riders as most other people. There are some suggestions that some banks have some sort of specific countries where they've already got subsidiaries, so life will be easier. But there you go. That has to be a pretty good starting list. And to any other European country, I'm not ruling you out, obviously, but if Citigroup is listing those, then that has to be a good place to start.
Vincenzo, is any one of those more attractive than other? Do they have particular problems?
No, I think it depends on the strategic choices that any bank would make. I think in terms of moving stuff, I think that I have the impression banks regard that as a last resort option because they want as much as possible try to avoid moving stuff because it's not easy and it's not cost-free, especially if you are operating in a with a hub and spoke type of model and you have little infrastructure in other EU member states. So that involves costs and of course, we go back to the point we made at the beginning. It's true. Inevitably, the worst case scenario has to be the central scenario when you make your contingency planning. But I think a lot will depend on how the negotiations begin and how the tone is set and how things evolve. Because it's true that these contingency plannings are on the table. table. But before pushing the red button, I think banks will want to wait and see, because it's not setting up a subsidiary. You need to obtain a license. You need to capitalize it. So it's not a cost-free operation. And moving stuff is really, I think, what banks regard as a last resort.
Dan, some of these continental cities obviously have some very different legal regimes and what have you to the city. Are there political issues at play on the continent? How far? I mean, if it's not particularly easy, we were saying earlier, for the government to kind of be seen to be bending over backwards to bankers in Britain, then presumably that's the same.
And we've already seen concern expressed by some bankers about employment laws in Paris, or even in somewhere like Amsterdam, which we think of as a very sort of open, free trading minded city like London. There are very different attitudes towards bonus caps, which are already causing sort of tensions as people try to sort of woo banks there. I think, though, just to pick up on the earlier point about moving, I think, again, my biggest worry is not about, it's not that suddenly 1,000 bankers will get tapped on the shoulder and say, hey, you're living in Frankfurt tomorrow. It's that over time, opportunities will be lost and hiring won't happen in London that might well have done otherwise. And that's so much harder to measure. And I also think what we haven't talked about is the signal that London's sending out as a centre of excellence for talent from all around the world. I mean, never mind what immigration system we end up with, and it looks like it'll be certainly more cumbersome and bureaucratic than what we have at the moment. But just culturally, we've sent this massive signal out to the best and brightest in Europe that actually, you know what? You don't come and start your careers in London, because you might find you quite a hostile environment. And that's totally different to what we've had certainly for the last 10 or 20 years, where you go to Canary Wharf and it's absolutely chock full of bright, young, ambitious Italians, French, Spanish, all thinking that London is somewhere they can kind of build their careers. And that's no longer there.
That's a very good point, isn't it, Anthony? I mean, this issue of free movement has got to be critical, hasn't it? I mean, I think roughly 60,000 EU nationals directly employed in UK finance, are highly qualified, as Dan was saying, highly skilled people paying what's more, you know, high taxes, we hope. The city's relied on foreign talent for very many years, hasn't it? What might the end of free movement?
It's definitely a concern for the city, for financial services in general. As you say, it's been very dependent on the highly skilled labour, and a lot of that in recent years has come from the EU, because they can just work here without having to get a work permit. And it's definitely been a huge strength for the city, that. And you know, certain banks I know employ 25% or more, 30%, 40% even of their staff are non-UK EU citizens who are worrying about their status at the moment. We haven't got a guarantee, but you know, in future those banks won't be able to simply import people over in quite the same way. But having said that, the political difficulty on freedom of movement has really been at the lower skilled end of the spectrum, and the sort of lower wage end of the spectrum. That was what I think, I mean, most political commentators agreed moved the dial during the referendum. And I think the government has made very positive noises from our perspective about having retaining a sort of an open regime for highly skilled labour who come in and generate a lot of wealth and pay a lot of taxes, etc. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, obviously you've got to wait to see what actually transpires, but hopefully there will be a system where actually highly skilled labour, not just in financial services, but in lots of other sectors like pharmaceuticals or, you know, the automotive industry or other areas, can actually bring the workers they need over.
Vincenzo, Vincenzo, is that where you think we're heading towards? Essentially some kind of work permit or visa scheme that would cover these kinds of employees?
I think it's difficult to say at the moment. I agree with Anthony. The intention of the government seems to be to maintain a relatively open system for highly skilled migrants, with restriction at the low skill end of the spectrum. Now, this seems to be the starting position of the government. Of course, you have to enter a negotiation with another 27 EU member states, and therefore a lot will depend on that negotiation and what kind of system is engineered, and whether the other EU member states are prepared to let the UK limit only one side.
Politics will come into it.
Exactly. Yeah. This is going to be an eminently political negotiation.
Yeah. Well, it actually doesn't necessarily have to be agreement with the other EU 27, because I mean, the British government can just say we're just going to have our own. I mean, I know there are, you know, voices in the government thinking this. So we just have our own immigration system in a way that America or Japan or whatever does. This won't be part of the negotiations of the EU. Mm. I mean, there are various different ways this could play out.
I worry more, though, about the cultural damage that's already been done. I mean, we're talking about some of the most highly skilled professionals on the planet. Many of these people could get a job anywhere, and they certainly probably get a visa in most places. But the point is that we've sent a signal out that London is no longer somewhere they can guarantee will remain open and tolerant. What's to stop the visa rules changing in 5 years' time when actually the government's finding that it's struggling to meet its targets or whatever? Or what is to say that the xenophobic sort of mood that some people report already feeling doesn't get worse? And I think that if you're someone graduating top of their class in maths and you're being dangled a job as a quant in the city, you could go anywhere. Is London still this cosmopolitan open place that we thought it was?
That's a good question. Jill, I just want to raise one more final point, because we did say at the beginning it isn't a one-way street. The London financial system is clearly, as has been said, systemically important for the EU as well. How worried should we be about, you know, any unforeseen effects of breaking up this, as we've called it, ecosystem? But it's an ecosystem that is clearly, at least as far as we can see, functioning at the moment.
Yeah, well, as always, I'm going to hide behind somebody else's analogies and not come up with my own. So I've talked about Douglas Flint and his Jenga tower. He's not the only person who's tried to describe the potential risks that could be there. Sir John Cunliffe, Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, has also given evidence to select committees talking about the potential risks that are lurking in the system should something somewhere happen. I mean, I don't think anybody really wants to say what those risks are, and I'm not sure that I'm particularly qualified to know either, but there is certainly this fear that the system has operated since the crisis. Maybe I should be touching wood, but we haven't had a major crisis, at least in the UK banking system, for a whole nearly 10 years. But the point that people make is that what we have had since the crisis, there has been more international cooperation about the way banks are regulated. So we now have these regulators in Switzerland, in Basel, who seem to be setting out tougher capital requirements. There seems to be much more agreement that clearing houses, which stand behind that Euroclearing thing I was trying to explain, are taking out some of the risks. So what are the risks? I don't know, but I'm going to hide behind Douglas Flint's analogy and Jenga towers unless Anthony can come up with something better.
Well, there have been huge reforms, as you're referring to try and reduce the risk in the system and make sure the financial crisis doesn't happen again. And I think there's a broad consensus that we've come an awful long way since the financial crisis. But the Brexit process is inherently risky. I mean, it's incredibly uncertain. We don't know what the outcome's going to be. These negotiations always tend to have a bit of brinkmanship. That, you know, people hold their cars, they walk, storm out, they decisions are made at 3 a.m. that people regret the following in the light of day. So we don't know where we're going to be. We don't know what relationship the UK is going to have once we leave the EU. And all these introduce risks into what is actually a very integrated financial system, not just integrated within the UK, but between the UK and the EU27. There's a huge interconnectedness there. So to take the Jenga tower analogy, it isn't just a Jenga tower in the UK, actually it's a Jenga tower, or sort of a bridge that goes across the channel, and you can start taking different bits of it and you don't know quite what is going to happen. So it is inherently risky.
What's your call then? Are we going to end up with a deal that will satisfy the city?
We hope so. I can say no more than that. I mean, I've given up trying to predict the future.
Vincenzo, do you think it'll work out?
I am optimistic that in the end, once the 28 member states sit down around the table, that we realise that there is a lot of a mutual economic interest in getting a good deal, and therefore common sense will prevail. So if not hard or soft, we will have a sensible Brexit in the end. But of course, I agree with what's been said. It's a negotiation, so there's always an outside chance that things go wrong, and there might be some brinkmanship involved. But what we have seen so far, I think, in the UK and on the continent, has been a lot of background noise, politicians sometimes playing to their respective galleries. But once the negotiations actually start, I think everyone around the table will realise that there is a lot of mutual economic interest in getting a good deal for the UK and for the rest of Europe.
Dan, a sensible Brexit?
I'm afraid I'm a lot more pessimistic. I think that economic rationalism is one thing, but actually this is about politics, and there's very harsh rhetoric we've heard on both sides. I think has already poisoned the well, has already made reaching a deal a lot harder, and I can't help but think that that's the way that both sides want this to develop. I think that the government is actually not really going into these negotiations with a sense of realistic options to offer both, to offer the Europeans. What they're trying to do is construct a narrative that when they don't get anything, they can blame it on Brussels and the intransigence of Europe. And I do think eventually there will be a comprehensive free trade deal which will replicate some of these things. But I think it may well have to be negotiated sometime after we leave, once the dust has settled. And in the meantime, enormous damage could be caused.
Okay, well, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming along. Please subscribe to Brexit Means to hear all our previous episodes. Thanks for your emails, your comments and your tweets. We do read them all. You can get in touch with us with ideas and suggestions by emailing brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. That's brexitpodcast, all one word, @theguardian.com. And that's about it. Thank you very much. Dan Roberts, Jill Trainer, Anthony Brown, Vincenzo Scarpetta. The producers were Phil Maynard, Rowan Slaney and James Goodison. I'm John Henley, and thank you very much for listening.